got everybody, we've got a quorum. Thank you very much, everyone, for being in the room.
Virtually and otherwise. Before I do anything else, I want to acknowledge that we're in Wurundjeri country and pay my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and especially acknowledge any elders who might be in the room with us, past, present or emerging, or might be listening to this recording afterwards.
Do you want me to use the mic?
Yes, I do want to use the mic. All right, this is even better.
Am I nice and close? Okay. Anytime we're talking about the nature of home, housing, place or shelter, we have to acknowledge that we're on a place that was taken from others. And I want to thank everybody who put this event together. This panel, if you're just walking in off the street, this panel is part of a kind of three-part event. And if you haven't been upstairs already, after the panel, you can pop upstairs and hear the audio installation, local positioning systems. And you can stick around in here afterwards and participate in the drawing, participatory drawing installation as well, which is called Drawing Home. It's all part of an attempt to get us thinking about, obviously, home and homelessness, but also the politics and the structural forces that make it what it is. Do I need to be up here? Oh, listen to that. Okay, that's better. Sorry. I'll lower my voice a little bit. So before we talk about the panel, I just want to say a little bit about the local positioning systems upstairs. That was based on interviews done by a few different researchers. Most of the interviews were done for a radio piece or radio series called Homeless in Hotels. I'm here with the co-producers for Homeless in Hotels, Spike Chapeloni and Kelly Whitworth back there. And if you look on the brochure here, there's a QR code which will take you to the Homeless in Hotels webpage if you want to listen to that afterwards. That's as much as I want to say about the event, except thanks to everybody for being here. Also, I want to acknowledge the people who funded this. Deakin Home Research Network and the Deakin Public Exchange Bureau also co-funded this. So thanks to them. What we want to talk about with the panel is we want to tease out one particular thread that shows up in the interviews and the sound installation that's playing upstairs. That installation was based on interviews recorded in and around lockdown, mostly with people who had been sleeping rough or staying in hotels, and all about the experience of homelessness, housing insecurity at that time. One of the threads that comes through there is the theme of criminalisation. And so as part of the panel, we want to talk about that specifically to kind of add some context to what you've heard upstairs and sort of bring you into the picture of what's happening right now. So the panelists today will talk a bit about what we mean when we say the criminalisation of homelessness, because that might not be immediately obvious to everyone, and also talk about what forms it has taken and what forms it's taking right now in and around Melbourne. When we say the criminalisation of homelessness, it's very rare that the state comes out and says it's illegal not to have a home. Occasionally they do. And if any of you have been paying attention to American politics right now, President Trump, if we can call him that, has just signed one of his many executive orders making it easier for American cities to round people up if they don't have a place to stay. And you may not be aware that at least 10 American states have passed laws making it possible not only to ban rough sleeping, but to force people into quote-unquote safe encampments. They don't call them concentration camps, but that is exactly what they're talking about. And I'm not over-egging the pudding when I say that, so watch that space. So when we say the criminalization of homelessness, sometimes we're talking about when the state makes it explicitly illegal, but just as often we're talking about the ways in which the state makes it impossible to legally exist if you don't have a place that you're paying rent on or paying a mortgage on. So they might make it illegal to pee in public, but there are no public bathrooms or not enough. They might make it illegal to camp in public, and there's not enough crisis accommodation. They might make it illegal to quote unquote loiter or to beg, but if you have no access to income and you don't have anywhere else to be, that makes it illegal to be homeless de facto. There have been forms of criminalization that go all the way back to the vagrancy acts of the 1500s, which forced people into slavery if they were quote unquote vagrants. So there's been various forms of that over the years, and we'll talk here just about some of the more recent ways in which that's shown up. I will stop talking too much and introduce our fellow panelists. I'll just go through and introduce everybody by name. But before we get into the discussion, we also have a recent couple of interviews that Spike and Kelly have done with folks. Oh, sorry, Meg and Spike have done with folks on the street, and so we want to put those voices first as well. But just before we get to that, hi, my name's David. I'll be your compere for the night, and I'm an anthropologist at Deakin University. So this is one of the things I've done a lot of research about. To my right is Greg Denham, who represents, Harm Reduction? Okay. All right. And I might pass the mic around.
All right. So just quickly?
Yep.
Very quickly?
Yep.
Okay, so Greg Denham, I'm on the board of Harm Reduction Australia, and I'm also the Australian representative for Law Enforcement Action Partnerships. I'm a former member of Victoria Police, and have worked extensively, in the drug and alcohol field, over quite a significant period of time, and I still work and live in the city, but today I'm here as a representative, bringing my experience of working, on the streets, and particularly in the drug and alcohol homeless field over, quite a long time.
Thanks very much.
Hi, is this on?
Yeah, you just have to be really close to it, apparently.
Hi. My name's Pat. I guess I had a long-term lived experience of homelessness that lasted into my 30s. I eventually got public. I was able to get public housing through some outreach workers that found me in a rooming house that I was staying at. That eventually led, once I got housed and I was able to get my health together, I did some peer education work with the Council of Homeless Persons. We used to do a radio show on 3CR called Ruminations. It's based on people's experience of living in rooming houses in Melbourne. I've also worked, I was a peer outreach and peer support worker at CoHealth for 7 years at Central City with where Greg, you still there, Greg? Yeah. And I'm really proud to say that I'm representing myself, but I'm also a peer advocate, a client advocate, and an overdose response worker at the medically supervised injecting room. So I'm not representing them today, I'm representing myself. But I think it's really important that we recognise the connections between homelessness and the AOD using community. I live with addiction. I'm not ashamed to say that I've lived with addiction for decades. And when, as David said, the criminalising of that community can make life is tough enough as it is. When you feel like you're in the crosshairs of various forms of security, layers of security, it makes life even harder. So,
Thanks. And I just want to add that Spike also was one of the people who recorded many of the interviews that were playing upstairs.
G'day, my name's Craig, also known as Turtle. I've been living on the street for a long time now. It's, I think it's close to 8 years, I think it is at the moment. Known David for a long time. He was one of the only people that used to chat with me on the street. Yeah, I'm here because David was telling me about this was all about how homeless people are being treated at the moment, and what the police have been doing and the security that's been out there and all that. So yeah, I'm here to answer any questions that you need to know.
Thanks very much. And Craig's also one of the voices you can hear upstairs. And then to my left is Meg Kennedy from the Fitzroy Legal Service. Do you want to say a few words?
Sure. I'm Meg Fitzgerald. I'm a lawyer. I do strategic litigation at Fitzroy Legal Service. I also have lived experience of homelessness during my early 20s and for a period as a single mother in my mid-20s. And I also have a long engagement with the Homeless Persons Union and some of the advocacy that they did as well, so with Kelly and Spike and other people. I guess I would reflect probably what some of the other speakers have said, just that intersecting identities and work and passions that we share, that we all sort of connected in this work by. I'm one of those people. I'm a lived experience lawyer.
Amazing. Welcome. And before we start asking the panel to comment on specific questions, we have a couple of interviews that Pat, Spike and Meg did to just sort of put us in the picture. These interviews were done in the last week or so. And so we get to just sort of give us, paint a picture of the present moment, and then we'll answer some questions about it afterwards. And we'll have time for questions from the room, of course, after that.
Yeah, so when Crownland security come up to you, they've got guns on them, you know, so they stand there, you know, all around you with guns on them, you know. It's like, it's not the best feeling, you know. And regarding, I get my, in terms of your belongings, it's hard to keep your stuff secure, you know, because you've either got to keep everything on you, which is hard. You've got blankets and your clothes and stuff. Yeah.
Do you think it's council workers taking your stuff, like?
They do that. But that's generally if people will leave their stuff, like sitting somewhere, like in maybe in the way, like, you know, say if you walk along and you might see someone's stuff just sitting there, yeah, the council come along and move that. But look, honestly, you know though that they'll do that, so you shouldn't leave your stuff sitting there. Look, they shouldn't really take it anyway, cause, I mean, it's people's blankets, you know what I mean, and especially in winter, like, wait, it's cold, you know what I mean, it's not warm, so you need your blankets. And it's not just easy just to go and go, oh, I'll just go grab a blanket. If you've got no money, you can't afford one. So again, generally, when it happened to me, it was winter, it was not too long ago. I was sitting here, all I had was like a thin jacket over me. You know, it was 1 degree. And luckily someone came up to me and put a blanket over me, you know, like just a, you know, a member of the public. So yeah, I was so grateful for them. But then I got something else. But yeah, you've got to keep your stuff on you, mate. Otherwise, I've got to carry everything around me every day. So otherwise, it'll get stolen.
Have you ever been threatened in the city of Melbourne? Uh-huh. Or do you feel threatened in the city of Melbourne by cops?
I don't know if I've been threatened. The way they talk to you makes you feel like they're, like you said, like before, you know, have they kicked you out and they feel like they intimidate you. They intimidate you. You feel like they intimidate you, especially when the Crownland security guys come. The police, they'll come and just, you know, they'll, oh, actually, no, they have once, actually, not too long ago. They threatened me to, they said, if you don't move, you'll be arrested and you'll get done for, I can't remember what it was he said something, and, yeah, so I got up and had to leave. So, yeah, they have once, that wasn't too long ago, but they've been around heaps. I know that they've been told to basically try to rid the place of the homeless, the city. I don't know whether it's because an event's coming or something like that. I know that, like, when they had the Australian Open, when they do that, there's an extra crackdown. They make sure there's not as much people homeless around, because they feel, you know, they want the visitors and all that to feel safe and all that. But it is what it is, mate.
I've been threatened with my life before, you know. And just, I don't know whether he was joking around, but I'm not going to, you know. They even shattered my wrist. The PSO officer shattered my wrist one time in Southern Cross.
Do you feel safe in the CBD?
Like, I do, but only because it's been so long now, and I've got friends around. We stick to each other. But look, giving you an example, a couple of nights ago, I was just sitting here and a guy went by, they were drunk, and he just kicked me in the stomach. Just booted me in the gut, and then they kept walking, you know? So, yeah, it happens, but that's life, mate.
Yes and no, you know, just, you know, when people say, you know, stay safe, I don't know how you're supposed to do that, because, you know, you never know what's going to happen, basically, so, you know.
That's what makes me feel unsafe. Probably just if like I said, the worst feel is when the police and that move you on. You feel like you got nowhere to go, when, especially I, and I know a couple of other people, we just try to stay out of the way. You know, try to find a little alcove somewhere. I don't try to sit in front of shops and door and stuff like that, or where people's walkway, like where I am now. I try to stay in a little way where I'm just out of the way. That's all I want. I just want to stay out of the way. But
drunk people, intoxicated people, you know, they're the worst. Yep.
Do you think the city of Melbourne does enough to support the homeless community?
Not in terms of the government or the council, but people are pretty good. You know, you can't fault the people of Melbourne. You know what I mean? They're pretty good. Always ask if you need something, you need something to eat and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'll give it to them. If anyone out there knows me from Jimmy from and Collins Street, I thank all them that helped me. So,
have you ever had stuff taken by the city of Melbourne?
Oh yeah, council. Yeah.
Can you describe what?
Bedding, clothes, everything. Just everything you own, they just take. They want to keep you at that level, so they keep getting funding. You know, that's what it seems like to me.
What do you think the city of Melbourne should be doing?
Well, honestly, I think, you know, when you look at the money that, like, they spend on, like, the train stations that they're building, which is just an absolute, it's ridiculous. I sometimes, like I said, I feel a bit, you know, intimidated in that. Imagine what it's like for the girls and the females out there. You know, like the one that got raped not too long ago from where I stay. You know, like, it'd be terrible for them. So they could do a lot more. Even housing, I know people that tell me that they're living in a housing block and there's, like, all these empty houses near them. Well, why aren't they housing people like me?
How would you describe the treatment that homeless people get by cops and security guards?
Oh, no, not good at all. Not good at all. Just less than human, mate, just less than human. I just hope they end up there, you know, so they can see what it's like, that's all.
Do you think that the rights of homeless people are respected?
No. Not at all. You know, just they categorise you. You know, they put you in the, you know, too hard basket, I guess.
Do you think there's enough support for homeless people?
They act like there is a lot of support and all this, but there's really not a whole lot. They'd rather employ, what is it, Crown Land Security and kick you off, you know, every street corner they can. Especially when there's big events on, they clean up the streets and all that. And when COVID was on, it just shows you that they can house the homeless, but they just don't want to.
So I want to start off, I want to come back in a in a few moments to the question of the private security and the sort of recent changes. But I wonder if I could just ask everybody to talk about, in your experience, like to respond to that in general and tell us about, in your experience, what you've seen the city do over, you know, over recent years. Like what has criminalization looked like in your experience, and what has been the impact of it? And can I just ask anyone to jump in who wants to, rather than sort of going around?
So for me, what those guys were talking, the way those guys talked about being categorized, the impact of stigma, it's incredibly profound impact that it has on people, like feeling socially excluded from the rest of the community, sounding like they feel very alone. The not feeling like part of the community. I just wish I could remember everything, but I found what those guys said incredibly affecting. Because there's stuff around not feeling welcome in public space, you know, not feeling like that they can inhabit a city that belongs to all of us, feeling like alienated from, you know, like you know, that they should feel welcome in the CBD, that they shouldn't feel like they're being watched and spoken down to and patronized and made to feel like they're not welcome. And the way they spoke about how they it was really clear to them that it was security, it wasn't the rest of the community, that was really clear to them that it was you know, security guards, it was cops, it was you know, the state or the local council, and it wasn't people in general. So, you know, like that's a really good understanding of what's happening to them and what's happening around them.
Yep. Anyone jump in at will, unless you want me to call on someone.
Okay, thanks. It's hard to know where to start, really, because I've been involved in this issue for quite some time. And what we have seen over the last probably 1 to 2 years in particular, we've seen council really promote and push the notion that we need security guards on the streets. And this isn't just Melbourne. I was at a meeting in Footscray the other night, and they look like they're going to go ahead with a similar approach there. And now the term they're using for the adoption of security on the streets is called the Melbourne approach, or the Melbourne. So we've got a label to it now. The council in Melbourne is predominantly conservative and driven by business. So business is driving what's happening on the streets with security and compliance officers. So what we are experiencing is one or two compliance officers all dressed in black, with about three or four security officers from Crownland Security, who have got the contract in the city, walking around targeting. At the beginning, it was in relation to aggressive begging and alcohol consumption, but now it's clearly just anyone that's on the streets. I was noticing on the video actually that someone was sitting on a park bench. They're just targeting anyone they don't want in a particular area at a particular time. And the business community, they are really pushing this hard, and as they are in Footscray as well. So, and you know, there are people on the streets who have been long-term homeless. They've got multiple and complex needs. There's many that we know who are traumatized, who've experienced family violence, sexual violence, alcohol and drugs. They've got some significant mental health issues, surrounded by five or six mostly males dressed in black, standing over them, basically bullying and coercing them into moving on. And the whole idea is to move people on. There's no other strategy with this. It's just about removing people off the streets. So we know that people are often linked into services, and that's really important. But we also know that many people in the city actually come to the city because they like being in the city. They have a community in the city. They hang out in the city. It's their place to hang out. And overall, there's no in terms of their impact, there's very little impact in terms of the people on the streets. It's mostly the business sector that's driving this, and their I guess power and ability to drive council towards cleaning up the streets. So that's the experience. And I just quickly, I'll finish. Sorry. The last aspect of this is that at this meeting the other night in Footscray, there was a number of people in the room, and a couple of other people said, "Oh yeah, Wyndham's thinking of doing the same thing." So, you know, Brimbank's thinking of doing the same thing. So this approach, this strategy, could actually increase. So it could actually grow and grow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you took a lot of the words right out of my mouth. No, you're right. You're spot on. These security guards have been walking around. I made the mistake of telling them where I slept the other night, and then I was asking for some change. They came up, surrounded me, and said to me, "Oh, what's your name?" And I'm like, "Well, do you really need it?" And they're like, "Well, you're going to have to wait here for the police." And I was like, "All right, I'll wait for the police then." And then they changed their mind. They were like, "Okay, no, we don't want to call the police. Just give us your name." And I'm like, "Oh, my name's Craig." And they're like, "Oh, where do you sleep?" And I'm like, "Oh, just down the alleyway there. There's a little spot that I sleep in." Two nights later, I came back and they'd bolted down these bumps so I couldn't sleep in there anymore. Everywhere I go, I see that now. And, it's hot. I think it's called hostile architecture or something.
Yep.
Yeah. They design the seats that you sit on in the street so that you can't lay down on them. They've got the dividers, spikes on windowsills so you can't sit there. And someone said to me the other day, "Oh, no, they're for pigeons, but they're spikes like that." A pigeon's not going to care about that. You know, they're big iron spikes. So, and apparently, I was speaking to another homeless guy the other day, he stuck to his guns when the security guards came up and said, "You got to move on." And he's like, "No, I'm not moving, not moving, not moving." And he's a really nice guy, this guy, wouldn't harm a fly. And they eventually just left him. So I'm not sure if they've actually got any power to actually move you. Like, I know they physically can't grab you, but a lot of people are just intimidated by having these four security guards surround you. Mm-hmm. You're sitting there with your hat out or your book, and five big burly blokes are standing there going, you know, of course you're going to get up and move. So,
yeah.
Maybe I can ask Meg to talk about the legal implications then. You know, what powers they actually have and what legal impact it has when they're facing the city doing this on a regular basis.
Yeah, sure. I actually need to acknowledge I'm on the Gunnar Karana lands. Unseated, just because I am, and I didn't get a chance before. I might just say in order, like one thing that I experience going into the city at the moment is that it has this really eerie feeling. Like, so once you've been a part of a community, you're always looking for that community. Like, where are they? And the streets seem empty to me. Like, they might be full, but they feel empty to me. And I feel a lot of concern because from my lived experience, women and children find the city to be a safer place to be if they're homeless because of CCTV and lighting and that sort of thing. And also they are an integral part of that Melbourne city, inner city community. And it is actually a privilege for a lot of people to be able to contribute directly to homeless people. in that environment. So it's quite a difficult time. The way in which this is operating is highly questionable, and I expect it will, it could not be the subject of litigation at some point, because the powers, it's complicated, but I'll try to step it out quite quickly. The focus is on beg arms, and ostensibly on beg arms and drinking in a public place, which are issues that the state government and the courts have a very different view of. They're not prosecuted, and that, you know, there's been a lot of law reform around those issues because of, well, particularly around alcohol consumption because of deaths in custody, around public begging because it's a poverty-driven offence, and if you're homeless, you've got a special circumstance, which means that it won't actually stand in court. So it's quite, you've got a private security group doing work that is not work that, it's anti-social work, really. And their power is to affect citizens' arrests. There's very specific circumstances that you can affect a citizen's arrest. But as particularly homeless community know, something doesn't have to be lawful to be happening. And I think one of the things around that, I mean, we're, Fitzroy Legal Service and a number of other legal services are working in this area and really hoping that there will be homelessness issues can be difficult to build advocacy networks around that are broad ranging, but I think actually in the community there is a lot of support for homeless community, and I think increasingly there's a really clear recognition that the cost of living and the housing crisis is just a fact. There's also a really reasonably high level of awareness of the increasing number of women and women experiencing family violence, children escaping from family violence that are homeless as well. I feel like that general awareness is present. But this particular action by the council, as Greg mentioned, is driven by some voices. And I think one of the issues is that injustice often thrives on relying on people not being empowered to take action against those authority figures. So it's incumbent on all of us in the community to be really committed allies at the moment and take this really, really seriously, because it is really serious. And I guess from our perspective, it's also complicated by the demolition of public housing issue and also by bail law reforms. So a lot of offences, like in a practical sense, that homeless community experience are a lot of offences that relate to activities that many people do, but they don't get prosecuted for them because they're not in public spaces. They're not relying on public spaces as their lounge. And, you know, sometimes dependence issues are highlighted as being central. They are central in a sense, but there are a lot of people in the state of Victoria that take drugs and alcohol in their lounge rooms, and it's just not an issue. But if you are poor and if you are struggling with housing, which can actually happen to anyone, as we're seeing increasingly, I think that's becoming more and more obvious that many, many people are only one paycheck away from homelessness. You can end up with a lot of minor offences. And what we've got also is the state government pushing really hard. I mean, they've introduced the first tranche of bail reforms. They're introducing the second tranche of bail reforms, which is a total backflip on the commitments they made after Veronica Nelson passed away in custody. And as a consequence of those bail reforms, it means that really we're looking at a highway into prison. And I think that's an extraordinary thing when you think about the cost effectiveness and the common sense and the logic of that, of preferring to spend all of these resources on criminalising people and incarcerating people as opposed to supporting them and housing them. It's something that I think that we need to think structurally about, and I really hope that I have hope, but I think it will take a lot of allies and a lot of educative work for the community, because I think the other thing is that these narratives that are run, the sort of shocking violence narratives that are run, they're quite easy to run, but they're not representative. I mean, the most family violence happens in the home, and that's not a news story, but maybe it should be, because, yeah, it's all upside down at the moment, but we're working on it. But I also want to acknowledge the grief and also the internalized stigma, because that's something I feel ashamed about, just being in a system that's doing that to people, that's expressing so much hatred towards people who are in circumstances of hardship. That's all I'd like to say.
Thanks very much, Meg.
Yeah, I'd just like to back up what Meg's saying and just remembering who the homeless community is. Indigenous folks make up 2% of our population, yet make 20% of the homeless community. Something like 40% of the homeless community is below 24. Something like in the, I think 15% are under 12. So we're talking, it's, and so the state and the people that have resources are putting money into prisons, knocking down public housing rather than building public housing. And so the thing, one of the explicit reasons for the security is public intoxication. Like, go to any pub, people are being intoxicated everywhere, yet they're not being criminalized, they're not being prosecuted, so right in front of us, what we're seeing playing out is those sort of that capitalism, the contradictions between rich and poor, the powerful and the powerless. It's happening right in front of our eyes. And I guess the other thing I'd like to say is, like, the space that space that used to be taken up by, I guess, when the late, not that I'm a big supporter of the Labor Party, but when the Labor Party had more of a conscience, and I think when the union movement was more active in standing up for people and standing up for communities that don't have access or don't have the resources to stand up to council and the state, they vacated that space. And so I guess, and again, I'd like to back up what Meg's saying, so I guess, and then it's up to people like us, is to put pressure on these guys, because, you know, they claim there's been 34 unspecified acts of violence over 2 years. That's just over one a month. Anyone that's worked, that's been homeless or worked in a service where, you know, in a homeless service, that could be someone telling someone else to get fucked. You know, do you know what I mean? It could be someone having a cigarette in front of. So that's no justification for having a private militia at all. And so, yeah, I guess, it's really important that these opportunities, like, I find it's really important that we get together and talk about this stuff and share our experiences and start talking about what we can do to challenge what's happening.
A lot of the time they've just, what do you call it, too hard, you know. This is just a quick little story about would have been a couple of years ago. I was walking through to Grave Street and there was some guy, had his girlfriend on the ground and standing over her about to hit her, and I'm like, oh, this isn't too good, you know. And looked down the end of the alleyway, saw a couple of police officers. Ran down to them and said, you know, there's a guy hitting his missus down there. They're like, yeah, we'll get to it in a sec. And they just kept walking. I was like, hang on a second, you know. 4 or 5 minutes later, they came running back. Someone had actually called. They'd got the radio call. And it's like, well, why did you have to wait for the radio call? Now, if that was me, like, yelling and screaming at someone, you know, they just would have been there straight away. You know what I mean? But a normal guy in a suit, you know, standing over his missus, his aunt even there, you know. Yeah, anyway, so.
Yep, thank you. Is this a good time to open up for questions from the room, do you reckon? Because I'm sure there are many, and please feel free to just jump in, otherwise I'll make up questions. We've got two over here, so Amy and Violet, and then anyone else, I can make a stack. Okay. Yep.
Ah, me. Hi, I'm Amy. I'm here from 3CR Community Radio, just doing the recording, but I'm also transgender. And something I know that's going on a lot in my community is sort of like an invisible homelessness, because it's incredibly scary to be transgender diverse and on the streets. So there's a lot of us couch surfing and just trying to get into share houses and whatever we can go. But I think there's a lot of people in my community that don't actually know what the different forms of homelessness are. I was just wondering if your housing research has what's the story with my community a bit. Yeah.
So in Australia, so there's no international definition, like internationally accepted definition of homelessness. So in Australia, in overseas, they tend to have more of a political definition of homelessness based on like rights and access to your rights. In Australia, we have more of a cultural definition based on the appropriateness of the housing, tenure, and the security of that housing. And I think the statistics are roughly that what we see on the street is a minority. It's a minority of people who are sleeping rough. The vast majority of people who are homeless are in overcrowded conditions like rooming houses, basically rooming houses and crisis accom. There's like a secondary homelessness, which is like caravan parks, and what you're describing, couch surfing, which is, yeah, more short term. And sorry, I didn't mention it, but the LGBTQA+ community. So for example, if the accepted thing in like that 1 in 10 people in the general community are at risk of being homeless, that's doubled in the LGBTQA+ community. And I guess it's really important that we acknowledge that that's down to violence in the community. People, you know, the lack of tolerance for people that are different. The way that we have difficulty respecting each other and treating each other right. And I guess what I'd like to say about that is it's really, and someone else pointing, it's really easy to employ security guards and take a really punitive approach than it is to sort of investigate and have a look at the way we run, how we treat each other and the way we run our communities, or how we can better manage our community and our resources.
Can I just add on something to that? Just to kind of put it in global perspective, like this is in one sense, it's always been true that the more vulnerable you are in general, the more vulnerable you are to homelessness. But in particular, in recent years, the more acute a whole range of inequalities get in a given society, the higher cost of living goes, the more divided people become, and then the more easily we are divided. So hiring private security, amplifying crackdowns is all a reflection of this just growing chasm between people who can afford to hang on to housing and people who can't. You know, so what we're seeing in the United States, they're just on the verge of being able to put people into actual, you know, concentration camps, because this sort of growing gulf, because this gulf is growing between people who can afford housing and people who can't, and any reason that you might already have been vulnerable is amplified by that.
Our bodies are like far, like, incredibly scrutinized. Like, any cis man in this room today dresses the opposite gender, put on makeup and go outside and walk down the street for, like, your normal outing and see how that goes, you know. And that's something that we go through. So when I meet people and talk to people in my community experiencing homelessness, they've had some horrible experiences on the street, but there's just a genuine terror of being out there just because of the vulnerability and the violence that we get. Yeah, I just wanted to add it to the conversation, that's all. But yeah.
I'm just about the militarized private security and them having guns now. I just want to ask, like, what are the legalities around them using those weapons and detaining people? Like, in my experience, private security can't actually detain you anyway, or something like, you know, the police officers can detain you, private security can't, right? And so, yeah, I just, like, what are their powers? What can they do? What can't they do?
Yeah, I'll answer that. Meg might want to answer it as well. So everyone has a power of arrest. So under 458 of the Crimes Act. So if you look at the 458, then everyone has, under certain circumstances, and Meg alluded to this before, the ability to arrest someone. And under 462A of the Crimes Act, it talks about use of force. Concerns me significantly that we've got people who are what I might describe as having limited training now armed in the city. We haven't actually seen them out on the streets walking around with compliance, but we do know, and if you go onto Crownland's website, you'll see them fully armed. So what worries me, and I was thinking about this before actually, that, you know, this sort of devolution of responsibilities and in some cases, in many cases, local government adopting, you know, these approaches of their own volition, it means that you now have groups of semi-trained or partially trained people who are taking more and more responsibility for enforcing laws, and particularly local government laws, and there's a lack of accountability in what they do. You know, police have an accountability system. There's a system, and I know it doesn't always work properly. I know it doesn't. I know it's got a lot of significant challenges, but we now have people on the streets who are basically semi-militarized forms of security services. And it's interesting that we haven't had anyone, apart from the agencies that submitted an objection to the council, like Melbourne City Council's moves to extend this approach. We haven't had anybody from the state government speak out against it. I think they're kind of happy for them, council, to take it on.
That was the point I was trying to explain.
Yep. Yep, because again, the debate becomes polarised. You know, we get this situation where there's alcohol, drugs, homeless, it's you know, situation where politicians don't want to be seen to be soft on crime. And the narrative we continually hear about these situations is we put it in a crime framework. We shouldn't be putting it in a crime framework. It's a health issue, not a crime. Sorry.
Oh, no. I might add a couple of points if that's okay. My understanding is that arrest would usually be used as a last resort. I mean, particularly in the type of offending that we're talking about local laws, infringements of local laws where you get a fine. And I think that what my read on it is that if you provoke a situation, into something that could become a breach of the peace, or where someone does commit an assault or commit an offence, then some other powers might come in, and then the police might get called in, and it can escalate in that way. But it's actually quite bizarre to me, because there's just so much risk in untrained people. Like, if someone asked us, something's, you know, should I commit, should I do a citizen's arrest? Normally we'd say no, call the police. You could get sued for assault if you do the wrong thing, if you're out of power, unless it's a real emergency. It's sort of like us sitting in a room and saying, hey, you know, there's some behavior. Shall we police it together? It's just a very high risk thing. And it seems that the way, well, definitely the way that it's being done is you have the local law officers who go in, then you have the private security who are there to protect them, and then when it escalates, the police come in, and it's just layering and layering and layering things onto non-events, which can escalate. But even if they don't escalate, it doesn't account for the trauma of that particular incident for the person, of being surrounded by so many people. And I think it's an area where litigation will happen, and maybe that's what has to happen. But I also want to say that this overall trend, it requires a really coordinated response, and I think that it can be really easy to feel completely overwhelmed and hopeless in the current situation, and also to get caught up on it's just a very difficult sort of emotional space to work constructively from. But my experience with the homeless community, primary and secondary is the terminology that we use. So primary are rough sleepers and secondary are people in insecure housing, can be very powerful advocates when they work together, and they can bring a lot of support from the community as well, because the message is so clear, and it's a really fundamental human rights issue. Message, I have a right to exist, equality before the law is protected under the charter, and what that should mean is that you know, like in for example in Port Phillip, they've been trying to say you can't sleep in public. Well, that's only going to be prosecuted on discriminatory grounds, and those grounds are actually protected by equal opportunity laws. So it's we're in such a sort of unsavory area in terms of lawfulness, but I think that that's one strategy. But the bigger and more important strategy, I think, is political organization, political education, and also really giving affected community the center, you know, centering their voice as much as possible, and supporting them to have a safe experience and to find avenues of support and solidarity. Because I want to echo one thing that Spike said, is that it's hard enough. It's hard enough when you don't have anywhere to sleep to survive those days, to just deal with all of that. And the way some of that is received is just so painful. And services can't fix that. It's something that we politically need to shift. And it takes many people to do that. So I really, really hope that there is some way that we can join forces, because a few people can influence a lot of other people if they're coordinated and committed. And I'm really grateful to be with you all today.
So I just wanted to add that I think, look, Meg is absolutely right. There needs to be accountability. One of the things that council staff and security staff are relying on is the fact that they can coerce people, bully people, stand over people. And we know, for example, that they've tried that with health workers in the city as well. They've tried to do the same thing with health workers who are doing outreach in the city, to try to move them on when health workers have actually challenged what they're doing, but they've backed off. So, yeah.
If anyone, I've seen this happen when the Crown Security are there, if anyone comes up and says to them, hey, leave this homeless guy alone, they turn around to the person and say, oh, we're here to help them. And then the people go, oh, okay, no worries, and they walk off.
And just, yeah, I have heard that as well. And they've also said to our staff, oh, do you realise it's an offence to impede a council officer in the you know, the course of their work. So yeah, I've heard the same thing as well. Right, yeah.
I think we've probably got time for to finish up and then one more question.
We'll get the question.
Hello, bear with me because the adrenaline is surging through my nervous system, and the more safety I have, the more able I am to navigate the trauma impact, and it has gone so far beyond trauma. It's gone so far beyond trauma that we may as well just call it the violence that it is. But I want to just backtrack to the question asked about the security people, and I just want to share. I even don't like the word share. I want to talk loud as possible to power. It's asked me to shout. And the unity is essential because I've been isolated even within the marginal realm of life. For me, it's a living death reality, subsisting, trying to get to survival. Help me stay on track. The lived experience merges with all the other experiences. So I want to just keep breathing so I stop the shaking in my body. The fear is so intense. My lived experience was that the police and the security guard used each other to get through the loopholes, and it was the police could not evict me on the particular night. They were called, they were present, but they used the security guards to execute the eviction because the landlord, which was my social housing provider, who was also using a loophole. My story is one of a crisis within a crisis within a crisis. So the Pandora box is ask you to jump with me, but we will get to answering the lived experience of how the police use the security guards, which jumping. My social housing provider, Common Equity Housing Limited, paid extra, so that the guardian security guards could wear guns. And they were there, not just one or two, to remove me, a single woman, from my home. The policeman, I overheard him ask the security guard, because they couldn't break through the front door without damaging the property. And I overheard the policeman saying, can we come back tomorrow? No, said the armed security guard, because that meant that I would flee and that they wanted to achieve an eviction on that night. So they had been told by my housing provider, Common Equity Housing Limited, to do it, do or die, make the arrest that night. And I was charged with trespassing in my own home, which involved a choice of sleeping on the nature strip that night, which I'd already previously slept for several nights on the nature strip outside my home, or just get through the back window and sleep in my own bed, which I did, only to have 3 days later this eviction experience of the armed security guards. I think there was about five that were there, plus the police. And then they brought in the contractors to board up all the windows and barricade the property. But the policeman asked, come back tomorrow, and the armed security guard said, no, the landlord wants us to do it tonight. And the loophole within a loophole was that Common Equity Housing Limited had malfeasantly sold my property, but the process of the payment hadn't gone through. So the person purchasing a public asset was using Common Equity Housing Limited, and Common Equity Housing Limited was using Mr. Fisher to lay the trespass charge. And this was the lay of the land in terms of the legalities of one loophole being used against me. But the point was paying extra a public authority, the social housing associations are functioning on behalf of government, obliged to act with charter lawfulness. I think you can all hear that there was a total breach of human rights in that lived experience. The cruelty, the debasement, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much for sharing.
The other thing is that there's the some of the protocols that can trigger the response from these security guards can be having too many bags. Four people, more than three homeless people being together is a breach of the protocol. So local laws that trigger a response from security are ridiculous, and how they stand up is beyond me, mate. Like,
I wonder if I could, because we're going to have to. Hit pause for the moment, and obviously this is a conversation we should keep having, and what we really hope is that everyone here finds a way to stay in touch with these issues and keep active. Well, I was going to go around the circle and ask if everybody could give us one or two thoughts about what to do next. Does that sound right? Like what you would, like those of you on the panel, could you each give us one or two thoughts about what you would like everybody to do from here? And I know we've got someone's brought a list. If people want to chuck their email addresses on it and keep in touch that way too. Oh, sorry. I'll just go around in the circle if that works.
So just quickly, okay, I'll compare and contrast Melbourne and Maribyrnong. So in Maribyrnong, Footscray the other night, there was, as I said earlier, a group of about 30 to 40 people who were prepared to take on counsel around the security service. I haven't seen the same thing happening until today in Melbourne, but I think it does need a community voice to push the opposition to what's happening in Melbourne. There was an opportunity not so long ago. I submitted a response to council's council's evaluation, which no one ever saw of the security service. But it does need some strong advocacy and activism around challenging what's happening, particularly in the city and in the other places that this approach is now going to be adopted.
I guess I'd like to just go back a bit to what Meg said earlier about people who have had a lived experience being central to any sort of challenge of the existing to what's happening now, and like maybe it's time for the Homeless Persons Union to be resuscitated and for us to get back to get together, because you know, it was an opportunity for people to be heard, to have their concerns about security, about service provision that wasn't up to standard, inappropriate service provision. So maybe Yeah, I think it's important that people who are directly affected are involved and supported to participate in a way that they feel like is, okay with them.
One of the things I was thinking that they could show was I noticed that a lot of people, when it comes to homeless, a lot of the programs seem to gravitate towards feeding you. You know, it's all about feed them, keep them alive while they're on the street, but not actually getting them off the street and housing them. So, and that's the problem. Like, there's a lot of places to eat, and, you know, a lot of shops will give you free food. You got Salvos, soup vans and all that, but no one seems to be making any more housing for us. And so, yeah, that's all. My idea is just more housing.
Meg, do you want to follow up?
Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I echo what other people have said. I think I'd really love to see the Homeless Persons Union reactivated with members and allies, because it's been an effective advocacy collective before, and we are in like really critical times at the moment. I also think that there's a lot of different collectives that could coalesce, and I feel like the more we can be proactive in generating those and sharing those details, and just having a collective commitment to this being an important thing to all of us, and dedicating some time to it, because it affects all marginalized communities, I think. And for me, like, I feel the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people at the same time as we're talking about treaty, and they're just really critical, brutal issues that need to be. There are people that need to be given a platform to speak to those. And I just think it takes a lot of organising, but it is inherently traumatic work, I think. Whether or not you've got lived experience, it's very difficult, because mutual aid is the critical thing that people need, which is housing. And I'm not a rich person, and none of us probably are. We probably don't have those resources to create those solutions. But I think committing to political organising and all of the myriad ways that can happen. And from my perspective, that's also a commitment to coordinating with other legal advocates who are looking at these issues as well. But I'm very deeply aware that litigation is really nothing. It's not nothing, but it's not particularly powerful unless it's community-driven and community-owned and community-led, and centering some of the. We've also had really amazing relationships with researchers and academics, and I think if there was ever a time that we needed a collective around community that are facing houselessness and safety issues around that, this is that time. So that would be my hope, that I'm on all the email lists. Just check me on. I'm there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The other thing is, like, the housing crisis. This whole idea of a housing crisis, when there's empty houses. There's not a lack of houses. It's a lack. It's the way that they. It's us having access to these properties. There's empty. I live on an estate, and there was empty public housing across the road from me for like 18 months. It's the way. It's a choice. The housing crisis that's fed into by the mainstream media has confected this, which has enabled developers and landlords to put up their rents. And it's just a money-making, it's a scheme. Like, and so it's something that we can fix. It's not unfixable, and it's a choice. It's a choice that the people in power have made.
Thank you. That's probably the kind of that's the overarching thought that we all need to keep in mind. Who is anyone? Was I right that someone's brought a list where people can pop their email addresses on if they want to keep in touch? Okay. Okay. So yeah, we'll collect email addresses from anyone who wants to keep in touch with the issue. I will. Yep. You can also, there is the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria Facebook page, which hopefully will become a bit more active in coming months. I just want to close up by saying two things. First of all, thank you all. Thanks to the panelists, and thank you to all of you who are just in the room for coming. And two, just to remind us that collective power has worked on these issues in the past. Just for one example, a lot of us know each other from 2017 when Melbourne defeated Robert Doyle's effort to ban rough sleeping, and these things sort of ebb and flow, and collective power has always made a difference. So keep in touch. Thanks.